Mental illness is a really difficult thing to live with. It's very stigmatized. It's hard to talk about. Mental illness is multifactorial, and so we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of genes are involved, plus environmental factors that we can't quantify or measure in any way.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, a telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we share an interview with a patient or a genetic counselor.
The risk assessment that we do comes from taking a really detailed pedigree. It's almost more like genetic counseling as it used to be before we had such widespread testing, before there was any testing at all. That other part of that description of genetic counseling about understanding and adapting to the contribution of genetics to your health or the health of your family.
Leslie Ordahl is a certified genetic counselor. She received her Master of Science in Genetic Counseling from the University of Toronto and currently works as the Assistant Program Director for the Masters in Genetic Counseling program at Boise State University, the first fully online accredited genetic counseling program. She also provides telegenetic counseling services to individuals through the Gray Genetics Network, specializing in psychiatric genetic counseling.
Yeah, so tell me, how did you become interested in and involved with psychiatric genetic counseling? It's not an area that a lot of genetic counselors know anything about or work in.
Right, so it's definitely a newer area of focus for genetic counseling. And I don't think most people have exposure to it yet in their training, although hopefully that will change. But it happened because really I was in a Canadian program. This was about, almost 10 years ago now. And psychiatric genetic counseling was really pioneered by Janine Austin at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And she, at that time, was making trips to the other couple of programs in Canada to give a lecture on it to the students at the time. So I was really lucky that I got to have that in-person lecture slash training. Mm-hmm. And then kept in touch with her. And as I started to see more developments in psychiatric GC, and I was, even though I was primarily working in research after I graduated, it always stuck in the back of my mind as, you know, something that was really interesting and also really needed. I think it tended to get overlooked because there's not typically any genetic testing involved with it. But as I followed the outcomes of the work that she and her team were doing and just seeing the difference that it made for people, it really stuck with me. And it became a focus, more than just a curiosity, but an actual career focus.
Yeah. And because that's not a common area of practice, how did you end up actually getting experience and getting to practice in that area?
It was really just saying, I'm going to do this. Even though I didn't have experience, say working in a rotation or a workplace that offered psychiatric genetic counseling, speaking with Janine, I was connected with some other genetic counselors that work at the same clinic in Vancouver. And that's a really interesting clinic because they actually have healthcare coverage through the province for psychiatric genetic counseling. So they have a lot of experience.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So they were wonderful people who really helped out in getting me resources and saying, you know, being really encouraging and saying, I'm so glad to hear that you're taking this on. And I really just wanted to take a stab at it, knowing that, you know, it's really like any other genetic counseling encounter. That's when I started seeing people privately.
Yeah. And I mean, you say like any other genetic counseling encounter, but like you alluded to, it is so different in that usually like there's a test that we could offer that we're discussing. And in psychiatric genetics, I think that's not usually the case, sometimes the case.
Right. And that is different. But it's almost more like genetic counseling as it used to be before we had such widespread testing, before there was any testing at all. If you go back and, you know, look at old documents or even newspaper articles about genetic counseling from pretty much up until the 80s, it was really purely risk assessment, looking at family history. And it was that other part of that description of genetic counseling about understanding and adapting to the contribution of genetics to your health or the health of your family. So that's really the focus, is helping people understand what causes mental illness, what the risks are for them to pass it on to their children, how do you adapt to it? Pretty much the heavy psychosocial stuff. And very rarely we talk about testing, usually in the context of pharmacogenomics for antidepressants or other psychiatric medications. But almost all the patients that I see are looking for preconception counseling, essentially.
Okay. Yeah, that was my next question. Is it very common that you have someone who's just like a young adult concerned about developing mental illness themselves? Or is it like more often it's just like the family planning and worrying about the risk for their children?
I'd say in the fee for service, like the private practice demographic, it is people who are family planning and really, you know, wanting to look at all the risks in their family. And they typically have a family history of mental illness. They may have it themselves, but more often it's in their family. And they want to learn about if there's any risk to their children. In a setting like this clinic in Vancouver, which is called the ADAPT Clinic, where they can see patients who aren't able to afford to pay out of pocket, there you see more people who actually, they may be at risk for developing mental illness, or they may already have it. And they may have it, in fact, it may be quite difficult for them to manage. And this is bundled up with other psychiatric care. And one of the interesting things I think that's come out of working with that population is seeing how it's changed people's, sort of approach to managing their condition. It seems to increase adherence to things like taking medications and being proactive about self-care, even when your circumstances are really difficult. Hmm. And I think it's because, you know, people have a lot of shame, but also a lot of personal guilt around having mental illness. And it's really hard to work on something and be positive about it if you have bad or guilty feelings every time you think about it. So I think the genetic counseling component and learning how it develops, how it can run in families, how it can be influenced by environmental factors can be really kind of a relief to people.
Yeah. What are some of the patient stories that have really stuck with you just in working with patients? What are some examples that you can talk about of how you've seen this really be helpful to specific people?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think for a lot of people, I mean, there are people that, you know, it's great to think of them, you know, potentially adhering to a treatment regimen that they didn't, you know, that they're having difficulty with before. I don't tend to see people more than once, so it's hard to know. But I think in a lot of the preconception counseling, it's really interesting to hear the stories in the family that come out. Especially, I see a lot of people with a family history of schizophrenia. And just to kind of normalize and give some explanation for why things happened the way they did. And giving people that context of just because, you know, you had a certain relative who did really poorly, who had a really difficult life, that doesn't mean that, you know, your child would end up the same way. Things just really seem to resonate with people. And I guess really giving people that empowerment through the knowledge is power model, I guess.
Yeah.
It's hard to really just like pick one.
But it sounds more like there's certain themes that yeah. have stuck with you.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for some people, they come again, it's very much about, you know, I'm having children and I want to know what the risk is, you know, ostensibly to avoid having a child with this condition, which of course you can never guarantee that, because everyone has a risk to develop a serious mental illness. Mm-hmm. That's just your general population baseline risk. But it's a lot of it, you know, people will start to say, well, this kind of explains what happened to my uncle, or, you know, I can kind of see why, you know, my sister didn't really want to talk about her illness. Now maybe she felt guilty about it. So just the information almost has like a ripple effect in looking at the family stories. So it's not always so much about the risk for having a child.
Or if maybe that's the reason that they actually think that they want the counseling, but then the benefit they get from it is sometimes more just understanding what's actually happened in their own family.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, especially when I have multiple family members that attend a session, it sort of seems to give them a framework or a place to talk through the experiences that have happened in their family, which may otherwise be really painful to talk about. But they can discuss it in a safe way where it's okay to mention things like schizophrenia, saying the word out loud, and then maybe make some sense of what happened to their relatives.
How do you, it seems to me like it would already be a challenge for families who haven't been able to discuss something like this, to get them all in a room. Like, how does that usually happen? Like, there's one person who just really motivates the other people to come, or is it that you have someone reaching out to make an appointment and then you encourage them to bring family members and that's how it ends up happening? Or how do you end up with that situation with multiple family members in the room at the same time?
It's usually, sometimes it's a surprise, which is okay. Fine. I don't usually encourage people to bring family members. I think especially with mental illness, there is so much stigma even within families and shame and secrecy. I don't want patients to feel like, you know, they need to bring along relatives or family members in case that's going to hinder their ability to get the most out of a session. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people will email me ahead of time and say, is it okay if my parents come, or is it okay if my brother comes? And, you know, that's fine. And I usually just try and get a sense of who everyone is at the start of the call. And especially if mm-hmm. I'm on the phone and there's no visual, I'll ask who all is there. So
usually you're doing this over phone or video conferencing. I know with Gray Genetics, obviously it's phone or video conferencing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so right now it's all phone or video. And which I know a lot of people have had to transition to that with the pandemic, but I've been doing that this entire time, really just because of access of where I live and being able to work with patients through Gray Genetics. So it's always been phone or video conference for me.
I think you alluded to earlier just that people's perception of their risk seems to be higher than it actually is, which is another thing that's common to other areas of genetic counseling. I feel like often people come into a session thinking the risks are going to be a lot higher. So in like those preconceptual counseling sessions, do you have people come in and thinking like it's 100% chance, or it's 50-50, or just much more elevated? Or how do you see that risk perception commonly is before counseling, and then how their perception kind of shifts?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a lot like other types of genetic counseling. I think I'd probably compare it to like cancer genetic counseling, where people come in and they think like it's 50-50 or it's 100%. And when you actually run the risk assessment, looking at their family members, it's much lower than that. I always ask people once I give them the risk figure, and I usually do it really right at the start of the call because, and say I'll explain it later, just to save people the agony of sitting there waiting to find out, you know, what the risk is.
Yeah.
I'll say this will make sense in a minute. But yeah, I always ask people to compare it to what they thought, and it's usually lower, but some people are pretty spot on. Uh-huh. I found, and I think a lot of people have done their own research, mm-hmm. and they pulled up, I've had patients with printouts of the papers that I use for risk assessment, and asking me about specific questions, which is great. But other people just, I don't know why they're, you know, they haven't done that kind of homework, but they just said, you know, their sense was about, oh, I thought it would be about 5% or uh-huh. something. Which is good, because then I can confirm that for them.
Right.
But yeah, there are definitely people who, I think especially with the more severe disorders, it's that sort of mental heuristic where your brain, you know, thinks of something bad and therefore the risk is high. Mm-hmm. It's like this unconscious protective mechanism. And so people think it'll be really high, like 50%, when the risk is actually maybe like 2 or 3%. And right. that's just really typical, I think, with any kind of inherited health condition.
Yeah. And do you see people who are sometimes kind of still on the fence about having children because they're so concerned about this risk? Or is it more often you're working with a person or a couple that, you know, they already know they want to have children. They just want as much information as possible to kind of have a better sense of what they might be dealing with?
It's almost always people who are on the fence. Okay. And I think one interesting dynamic that I see is people who are in the stage of their relationship where they're talking about getting serious and staying together and starting a family, but they either haven't gotten married, haven't committed, haven't really decided that they want to stay together. And it's usually, you know, there's something running on one, like one side of the potential family. And so that can be interesting because people are deciding whether or not to have kids, but I think sometimes they're also deciding whether or not to stay together. Mm. Yeah. So, and frequently it's also to reassure relatives who are not present at the session.
Right.
So.
Do you have patients now, who are coming in having already done some testing that they ordered online or with certain testing that they think is going to make a difference? Just thinking about, I don't know specifically what's out there in terms of direct to consumer testing options, but there's so many promises.
Yes, there are promises. And yes, I see people who come in with a lot of direct to consumer testing, sort of in the vein of 23andMe, you know, just like a general overall health screen and sort of carrier status, you know, genotyping. And, you know, when I ask people about, you know, either they want to understand more, or I ask people if they have results to please share them with me so that I can take a look and help explain them. And a lot of people just said, you know, I thought about genetic testing and there was a promo on Amazon that popped up for some company. And there are so many of these direct consumer testing companies now that are, you know, they pop up for a couple of years and then they disappear. It's really hard to find out a lot about their testing methodology. But ultimately in for mental illness and psychiatric conditions, it doesn't really matter. With very few exceptions, such as, you know, 22q, where there's a high risk of schizophrenia and we have a, you know, clear inheritance pattern. Mental illness is multifactorial. And so we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of genes are involved, plus environmental factors that we can't quantify or measure in any way. And so if you come with a direct consumer test that gives you, you know, here we looked at six spots in the entire genome and all of your DNA and made a risk assessment based on that. And, you know, the risk assessment may be like 3% higher than normal, but doesn't even give you the baseline. People are saying, you know, oh yeah, I didn't really understand it, or it turned out not to be that helpful, but hey, it was only $99. So
right.
Yeah. Really most of the risk assessment that we do comes from taking a really detailed pedigree.
Right.
Yeah.
It sounds like people have done that. They're like, why not? It gives me a little information, but they're not really surprised that it wasn't helpful.
Or they're not, most people are not overly, you know, upset over it. It just, you know, is maybe just kind of disappointing that they didn't get more information out of it. But it also leads into other discussions about, you know, especially for these preconception sessions, is looking at things like carrier status. And then I can at least make some recommendations if they want to go down that route or not.
Right. And what about, you mentioned earlier, the pharmacogenomic testing? Do you have people coming in with those test results or asking questions, or is that something that you mentioned?
Yeah.
And how that can be helpful with medications?
Yeah. And so I don't typically see people who've done it. I think it's still not terribly widespread, and as a direct to consumer product, it doesn't have the reach that the overall kind of health and wellness panels do right now. But there are a couple of tests that are geared towards pharmacogenetics for medications that are used for mental health or psychiatric conditions. I don't ever recommend that people use them. Sometimes people will see their doctors mention it to them. And I think the main thing that I want people to know about them is they're not testing for efficacy of the drugs. They're not going to tell you if a drug is likely to work for you and reduce your symptoms. They will tell you if you have a higher likelihood of side effects. And there's a lot of marketing for a lot of these tests that doesn't really make that distinction and can maybe understand, like, you might sell more tests that way.
I'm sure that's not accidental. Making that distinction.
But it's really a surprise to people, as you can imagine, because, you know, what's the point of this test? Like, side effects. And
well, if you have, I mean, potentially really bad side effects.
Like, And most mental health, you know, medications are trial and error, and you have to go through, you know, different drugs, different classes of drugs.
It can be helpful.
It's most helpful for a person who has never been on mental health medication before. If they've already been on at least one, like the utility, the usefulness of having that test done goes way down.
Does it help with dosing? I know pharmacogenomics for certain drugs, I think, might help guide dosing, but is that not true with psychiatric medications?
There's no guidelines. It's really, it just falls into those very broad categories of, you know, consider a lower dose or consider, you know, and it leaves it up to the physician to decide.
Right.
So it's not the same as some of the other pharmacogenetic tests that are very clear about the exact metabolism of, you know, blood thinners or some of those other medications.
So I often, when I have genetic counselors on this podcast, I often ask them about how they see the role of the genetic counselor evolving. And often that ends up being kind of, the answer sort of relates to genetic counselors being involved in post-test counseling. And then that's, you know, it's so different, as you were talking about, with psychiatric genetic counseling, where it's like the counseling itself that's the biggest benefit. So how do you see psychiatric genetic counseling evolving? And do you think, like, that shift in general in the field toward genetic counselors working post-test is going to make it harder for patients and kind of the healthcare system to realize the value of counseling, like psychiatric genetic counseling? Or how do you see all that kind of fitting together?
Right. I see it sort of taking a different trajectory than, say, cancer genetic counseling and cancer testing, which is just one example of where we see a lot more post-test counseling. Patients don't see a genetic counselor until they are getting results that their physician or another healthcare provider has ordered. I see psychiatric genetic counseling a little bit more like the expanded role of the genetic counselor in, you know, branching out into different areas of medicine that we haven't seen them before. I know of a genetic counselor who is now working in a family physician clinic in the U.S., and that's kind of a new thing, but she's available to help explain all different kinds of conditions, many of which there's no testing for. So I see this as potentially something that can be bundled with really normal psychiatric care, like seeing your psychiatrist regularly, or, you know, even as a one-off. And then there's also potential for the field, especially with the polygenic risk scores, as we get better at interpreting all of these different, you know, little spots in the genome, all these different SNPs and changes that contribute to mental health risk. You know, if we get some more robust predictions, and I don't think there's any right now, but it's genetic, so give us 5 years and we may be looking at something totally different. Then there may be more of a role for testing as part of it. But I think I think with genetic counseling as an entire field, it's not just arranging tests. It's not all just test related. Like I said, it's that other part of the definition of what we do, is the understanding and adapting to your genetic condition or the contribution of genetics to your health.
And the model that they have at the University of British Columbia, do you see that potentially working elsewhere in Canada, or do you see that working in the U.S. with our healthcare system, or do you think that'd be difficult just because we have such a different setup?
I guess I could see it in a couple of ways. I definitely could see it in other parts of Canada where we have healthcare that's paid for by the provincial government. And that's something that I think can easily, you know, kind of be bundled with, you know, going to a mental health specialist. I think it's something that is relatively easy to work into a care model, at least theoretically, the actual logistics being much more difficult. In the U.S., I think it's, gosh, it's like anything else. It's the U.S. healthcare system is so fractured and so variable I see more of a place for it, unfortunately, for people who have the privilege to pay extra to have it done, mm-hmm. which is currently a lot of where you see psychiatric genetic counseling really outside of Vancouver is, mm-hmm. you know, people who can afford the extra fee. And I think it's something that can be very easily done. But it's like any other kind of access issue in genetic counseling for any kind of condition. You know, there are a lot of hurdles just to the most basic healthcare, and those are going to limit access to this kind of care as well, even with good outcomes, even with showing that it's potentially can, you know, help people stick to their treatment regimes and everything else. I think also getting people aware, like genetic counselors, students and new grads aware that this field exists, and then getting them some training or access to mentors who are willing to, you know, share their information and share their skill set and teach people how to do this.
Yeah, so I know there's a lot of genetic counselors who listen to this podcast, as well as aspiring genetic counselors. So for someone who's really interested in working in this area, what would be your advice to them? How do you get that experience and get those mentors?
Right. So, you know, with me, like I said, it kind of happened because I was training in Canada, right place, right time, to have Gina Austin come and give a lecture to my cohort. But I think now there are some genetic counselors who are working in psychiatric genetics. The clinic in Vancouver, the ADAPT clinic, for any genetic counseling students who are listening, they have a summer internship, a competitive internship every year that I highly encourage people to apply for if they want to get experience. And then anyone who isn't a member of the National Society of Genetic Counselors, so NSGC, join the psych special interest group. There are a lot of very experienced people on there, tons of resources. I frequently check in, or, you know, it's given me a network of people that I'll say, you know, I'm really not sure about this particular pedigree that I'm looking at. I wonder if, you know, you could help me walk through this this risk estimate given these different factors. And, mm-hmm. you know, I found a lot of really willing people to just like jump on a call with me and give me some advice. So it's a very, yeah. it's a small group, but I think very encouraging.
Yeah. Kind of consistent with other areas in genetics, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like usually people are like excited, like unlike in some professions where people are more territorial and
oh yeah.
genetic counseling, I feel like people are excited that you're interested in.
Absolutely. No, there's people who are like, it's so great that you're doing this. And I mean, I get a lot of referrals actually from Janine herself. People will look online, I think just start Googling about, you know, I don't know what they're Googling, but probably something like, you know, mental illness inheritance or can you pass on depression? I don't know how they get there, but they usually end up on, you know, with Janine's contact information and she will refer them to someone like me.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just a matter of getting people trained and then hopefully integrating it into the clinical space on a wider scale.
What would you say to someone who's listening to the podcast and has mental illness themselves, or they have a family history of mental illness that they're concerned about? Maybe they're thinking about having children with a current partner, or just the hypothetical idea, and it's just something that kind of is back or front of their mind as something that they worry about and wonder about.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, look into psychiatric genetic counseling, and that may seem like the obvious answer, but I'm doing this because I see the effect it has on people, and I see how it can help people navigate through a really difficult situation, whether it's trying to decide about having children. That's a huge life decision. It has impacts on, you know, not just your immediate family, you know, your potential children and you may be your partner, but other relationships in your family. So whether it's that and giving people the most accurate risk figures I can give them, as well as information that may help them think a little differently about the possibility of having a child who may eventually develop a mental illness and how they would cope with that situation. What can they do as a parent? So really trying to give people the knowledge to make these decisions, but also for people with a personal history of mental illness, just to be able to learn more about how it happens. You know, what are the factors that contribute to it? How might that explain their own story, their own illness, and maybe make them think about it a bit differently in a way that's more useful to them. Mental illness is a really difficult thing to live with. It's very stigmatized. It's hard to talk about. And I think for those reasons, it can make it difficult to approach treatment, to stick with treatment, because, you know, it's taking something very painful and facing it head on. Mm-hmm. Where I see in psychiatric genetic counseling is perhaps making it a little bit less painful to think about, maybe feeling a little bit less guilty or ashamed about your own illness, or maybe giving you that sense of empowerment that you have some control over the way you feel. And we have biological explanations for this.
If you'd like to share your story, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any commercial genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. You can now donate to Patient Stories online by going to graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you don't want to make a monetary donation but still want to support the show in another way, leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our episodes through social media also makes a big difference.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.